You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Kim Hahn. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. Later in the program, we'll hear from Dr. Ray Schnapp, Conservation Director of the Indiana Forest Alliance, about a new report that is critical of Indiana's logging policies. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, African-American baseball player George Shifley was born as the son of a slave and buried in Bloomington's Rose Hill Cemetery in 1962. Shifley grew up in Bloomington, but it wasn't until 2015 that his unmarked grave was given a fitting monument for one of Monroe County's most celebrated athletes. Bob Hamill tells George Shifley's story on this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The Bloomington Utilities Service Board approved a $1.9 million contract with Utility Metering Solutions for a so-called smart watering metering system. Assistant Engineering Director Brad Schrader addressed a portion of the contract in the board's meeting last night.
This project is for all the services related to project management of installation of the meters, and including the meters. So this includes all the labor necessary to swap out all the meters in the system, manage the whole project, and then also do data integration. So as the meters are swapped out, the automatic reading data is uploaded, new meters are uploaded, and they ensure that the meters read and we're able to actually, the system works.
According to a press release from the City of Bloomington, both the utilities department and the customer will be able to get more detailed usage information with the new water meters. The system reportedly provides functions not previously possible and some that are currently performed manually. Those include on-demand meter reading, the ability to measure water usage automatically and remotely. The smart meter system can also connect and disconnect service, detect tampering, and identify pressure issues and leaks. Schrader told the Utilities Service Board last night that the contract is not to exceed $1.9 million. Installation of the smart metering system is anticipated to be completed by March of 2020.
Authorities say a box truck has damaged a 135-year-old covered bridge in Greene County on Friday. The Greene County Sheriff's Office says that the 52-year-old truck driver went through the Richland Plummer Creek Bridge on Friday. Greene County Sheriff's Office claimed the driver knew that the bridge had been damaged but didn't stop or report the incident. The Associated Press says Greene County deputies caught up to the Bedford man while responding to an unrelated crash. The Sheriff's Department has recommended a misdemeanor charge of failure to stop after an accident. The report did not state how badly the bridge was damaged or estimate the cost of repairing the 135-year-old bridge.
Classes resumed this week in a Richmond, Indiana middle school where a student was shot dead last month. A 14-year-old boy reportedly killed himself in a stairwell in Dennis Middle School in December after a shootout with police. Students returned to classes yesterday. This year has been the deadliest year for gun violence in Indiana in over 40 years. Last month's apparent suicide was the second school shooting at an Indiana middle school in 2018. Earlier in the year, a student at Noblesville West Middle School brought two handguns into a classroom. He was able to shoot another student multiple times before he was tackled by his teacher, who was also shot multiple times. Both the student and the teacher have survived, although with some serious injuries. Last month, the Indiana legislature convened to begin the so-called long legislative session in Indianapolis. This year's legislative session of the State Senate and State House of Representatives is called a long session because its legislators will approve a two-year state budget. Among the pieces of legislation being introduced are two gun safety bills advanced by Bloomington Senate Democrat Mark Stoops.
I filed two bills, or Senate Bill 307. Senate Bill 307 deals with some of the loopholes in Indiana law that allow easy access to guns in the state. The first part of Senate Bill 307 would actually require that every gun sale go through a licensed dealer in the state. And so that would allow for a federal background check on every sale. Currently with private sales, even if they're at a gun show or out of the trunk of somebody's car, that's not required. So this is a universal background check requirement. Another part of Senate Bill 307 is making it illegal for anyone under the age of 21 to purchase a semi-automatic weapon. That would mean that, you know, you've got an individual who may not have all of their neural connections in place or the maturity to be able to handle a weapon with that kind of power and capability. And that's something that's passed in other states, and it's something I hope the Indiana legislature will look at. The third part of Senate Bill 307 is banning bump stocks, which basically turn weapons into machine guns by you only have to pull the trigger and it'll just continue to shoot. And so bump stocks have been used in some of the most deadly shootings that we've seen over the years, and especially has reached some notoriety in the last year or two. And there's now an actual federal ban on bump stocks, but I would like to try to make sure that you get some language in state law as well, in case there's a Trump changes his mind on this in a month or two. You know, it's something we would still have in Indiana.
Bloomington Democratic State Senator Mark Stoops speaking there about Senate Bills 307 and 309 regarding gun safety legislation he's advancing in the state legislature. We'll have more on Stoops' push for gun safety reform in Indiana in tomorrow's Daily Local News. Both bills will be put into committee, where they would have to come up for a vote and pass in order to have a chance on the legislature floor.
Over 1,000 Indiana University students will be forced to live off campus during the school year of 2019 through 2020. According to the Herald-Times, several hundred rooms in IU residence halls tested positive for mold since October, caused by condensation from the air units. Afterwards, according to the Indiana Daily Student, IU students filed a class action lawsuit against the trustees of Indiana University for breaches in their residential contracts. The IU Board of Trustees has since moved to close the Foster and McNuck residence halls for renovations next school year. The renovations were scheduled to take place later, but were moved up to deal with the mold problem. IU officials have said that a full renovation is necessary to ensure that the problem doesn't recur. Displaced students will be able to live in off-campus apartments managed by the university. The apartments will have residence assistant staff on hand, and students will not be charged the normal extra fees for off-campus housing. The apartment complexes have parking and transportation to and from the IU campus, and that will be provided as well. The locations of the apartment complexes have not been made public yet, but university officials expect affected students to be informed soon. Students who do not wish to live in the apartments may cancel their housing contract with no penalty. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Kim Hahn. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4444. 4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The Indiana Department of Natural Resources Department of Forestry is responsible for the state's forests. Logging in state forests has increased significantly since budgetary reforms in 2005 and 2006 changed the DNR's funding mechanism. Now the state organization supplements its budget by selling timber and access to state forests to logging companies. But according to a new report released yesterday by the Indiana Forest Alliance, those sales average lower returns than timber sales on private land. In today's feature report, WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with Indiana Forest Alliance Conservation Director Dr. Ray Schnapp about the new report and logging in public lands.
What we ended up doing is talking kind of in generalities about the lack of transparency in the process, because we feel like we should be able to figure out how much it costs to manage our state forests. But what we found was that the State Forest Procedures Manual says that certain costs should be excluded. So they're just kind of systematically excluding costs associated with management of invasive species and anything that's not like directly related to the sale is excluded. So that includes a lot of staff time and writing up the resource management guides for different tracks and that sort of thing. So, and some other excluded costs include things like road building. We know that building roads is expensive, but we're really unable to pin down a figure as far as how much they're spending to build logging roads into our state forest to provide access for those sales. And then the other kind of major finding is that our state forest timber is being sold for prices that are far less than privately owned timber. Private timber sales typically are categorized according to high, medium, and low quality. And what we found was that the state forest timber is going for prices that are lower than the lowest quality private sales. So that's kind of startling, especially considering that our taxpayer dollars have been used to manage these forests for many years now, but we still aren't getting a very good price for it.
There are a number of recommendations that come out of this report, and I was wondering if you could take me through some of these. One of those, obviously, as you had mentioned, would be a greater transparency on behalf of the state DNR Division of Forestry when it comes to things like timber sales, or you had mentioned like road building and building logging roads. What are some of the other findings or recommendations that are coming out of this report?
Well, kind of along the lines of transparency is we'd like to see better cost tracking systems so that there was not this systematic exclusion of some of the costs, and or if we are going to continue to exclude them, at least we could track them and know what those costs are, to really know how much it costs us to manage our state forests in this way where timber sales are kind of the priority. And we think that our state forests have more value for recreational purposes and for just for wilderness, but nobody is looking at that yet. And then we'd like to be able to obtain better prices for the timber that is harvested from our state forest so that we could harvest less and still fund the agency, but harvest less from state forest land.
If I can interrupt you, Dr. Schnapp, you had brought up a very interesting point there by saying we could harvest less if we got a better price and that would help fund the agency. And something that I think a lot of listeners don't necessarily know is that the DNR's Division of Forestry is partially funded by things like timber sales of state-owned land.
Right. In about 2005, 2008, we had a big restructuring of state government, and the property tax funding was restructured, so it dried up a revenue stream that was going to the state forestry fund that was eliminated during that restructuring. So the agency had to look elsewhere for funding, and they began to ramp up timber sales at that time.
You're saying they began to sell more of those timber sales in an attempt to kind of match that funding that was restructured or taken away from that agency?
That's right.
And that, I think, would have been during the Daniels administration. Does that sound?
That's right. Okay. Exactly. Yes.
Another thing that you had mentioned was that on average, the timber that is sold from private land will go for a significant amount more than timber that is harvested on public land, in this case, state forests. Can you explain why that discrepancy or what in your findings would indicate that discrepancy exists?
Well, the Association of Consulting Foresters, they track timber sale prices that where a consulting forester was involved. So it's not all the sales in the state, but it is a pretty representative selection of larger timber sales, and they categorize them according to high, medium, and low quality. So the statistics are there, the data exists. And we just looked at that data in comparison with the data from the Division of Forestry annual report, and we found that our state forest timber sales are bringing in really low prices compared to those private sales. And one reason that the Division of Forestry has given is to they say that state forest timber is low quality. It's just really low quality, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us because they've been managing our state forests for all these years. So why is it low quality then? And there are other factors that might impact the price that we get for state forest timber. One of them would be just the ease of access, because state forests tend to be kind of remote. But then if we as taxpayers are paying for logging roads to be built in our state forests, we're kind of subsidizing the sale of our timber. So those excluded costs would actually make the picture look worse than it does. And it looks kind of bleak already, like we're not getting a good price. And there are some things we could do to get better prices for our timber. It's rather hard to judge the quality of the timber while it's standing. So some companies will cut the timber and evaluate the logs after they're cut to see, you know, if there are like knots and whether the tree is hollow and that sort of thing. And you can get a much better price for your timber if you do it that way, but that is not the way we're doing it.
Dr. Schnapp, there are several other recommendations on this report, and if you could just briefly touch on some of these. One that you had been mentioning before I had interrupted you was reducing the timber harvest levels. What exactly does that mean?
Well, we at the Indiana Forest Alliance, we've been advocating to set aside some areas and harvest less timber from our state forests for a long time. We've been saying that. And asking that some areas be allowed to become old growth and be truly set aside as wilderness so that when hikers go into a wilderness area, they don't experience a clear cut, those kinds of things. So just sort of balancing out the various uses of our state forest so there's not so much emphasis on timber sales and more emphasis on the value of recreational use in some areas.
Dr. Schnapp, I'm wondering how widespread is this issue or are timber harvests throughout the state? I mean, is this something that is happening in every single one of Indiana's 92 counties, or is this only where there's a state forest? Or what can you tell us about the prevalence of state sales of timber?
Actually has about 5 million acres of forested land, and by far most of that is privately owned. We have a thriving timber industry, and state forests only represent about 3% of our forested land, so that's a very small contribution to the overall industry. But that 3% of our forested land is publicly owned. It's our state forest, you know. And so we have been advocating for protection of these areas with more emphasis on recreational use because we don't have that many large forests in Indiana. Most of our forests are small, and especially in the northern part of the state, many of them are less than 25-acre parcels. And a lot of those are along waterways that may be flooded sometimes. Then most of our forested land and most of our state forests are in the southern part of the state. So I think that especially in the northern part of the state, it's easy for people to forget that we do own these large parcels of state forest land. And they're a really important asset that we should protect, both for wilderness recreation and also for the wildlife that live there.
That was Dr. Ray Schnapp speaking with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about the report released yesterday about discrepancies in logging practices in state forests. Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Bob Hamill. A few lines in the June 9, 1962 obituary section told Bloomington Herald telephone readers of the death at 67 of George Shively, quote, a well-known amateur baseball player who lived most of his life here. Amateur? Try professional. And well-known? His passing didn't get even a mention on the sports page. He was buried at Rose Hill Cemetery in an unmarked grave. More than 50 years later, when the Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame came into being and the search was on for early day stars who deserved inclusion, the story began to take shape of just how genuinely well-known this baseball player named George Shively once was. He was bountifully blessed with baseball's essentials. He could run and hit and chase down fly balls with the best of them. He just couldn't play with the best of them in baseball's major leagues because he was black. George had been born on a Kentucky tobacco farm, first-generation son of a freed slave. He and his father, along with George's two sisters, moved to Bloomington in time to be listed as residents here in the 1900 census. At Bloomington's, quote, colored school, unquote, in the 6th Washington block that later became the site of a Carnegie Library, now the Monroe County History Center, George went as far as 5th grade. Then he went to work. In his teens, he made the starting outfield for the professional West Baden Sprudels, whose daily rivalry with the neighboring French Lick Plutos was summer entertainment for the high society guests at the two luxury hotels. In 1914, about the time George turned 20, the nucleus of the West Baden team went with manager C.I. Taylor to form the Indianapolis ABC's team that played in and won the championship of the new Negro American League. Young outfielder and leadoff man George Shively was an all-star and the league's most valuable player. He went on to win another MVP trophy and make the all-star team 7 times. It's pretty apparent that he was the best baseball player ever to grow up in Bloomington or Monroe County. He had a 14-year pro career, traveling throughout the U.S. and abroad. When the speed and the skills weren't there anymore, he came back to Bloomington, where he was employed as a roofer, into his 60th year when he died and went to his unmarked grave. When the Hall of Fame sleuthers went to work half a century later, Google was available to tell the story that newspapers of George Shively's day missed. The story was made public, including the unmarked grave indignity, and the Bloomington community responded with generosity that financed the handsome limestone marker that now calls attention to where the great baseball player George Shively is buried, and separate markers for George's wife, Lula, and each of the 8 other African Americans were buried in anonymity in the same Rose Hill plot, and one for George's father, Joseph, whose actual burial site at Rose Hill was uncertain. On a sunny Sunday afternoon April 5th, 2012, Easter Sunday for Christians, opening day for another Major League season in a sport now enriched with African-American stars. A crowd of Bloomington citizens came to Rose Hill to see that marker dedicated. The presiding minister was two-time IU football All-American, the Reverend Anthony Thompson. The rich, powerful voice of IU professor Tim Noble that has launched 100 Hoosier basketball games at Assembly Hall with the national anthem on that afternoon sang Amazing Grace. Amazing. The voices Nove singing group sang. It was an unforgettable day. Way, way overdue, but unforgettable. And that community-sponsored grave marker stands as one of Rose Hill's many tourist treasures. Make a point to go see it.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal. Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin and Andrew McKeeran, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welsh with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is executive producer Wes Martin. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. For WFHB, I'm Kim Hahn.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a daily local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.